The meeting will come to order, please. The legislative assistant will note the roll and Representative Norton, would you move the minutes, please?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Norton moves the minutes of February 21. Is there any discussion? Seeing none and hearing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes for February 21, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The motion carries. The minutes are adopted. Members, today I want to say a thank you to our GOP researcher, Emily Nessie, who is leaving us after today to go on to another world. I believe it's the world of lobbying.
Generally, yes.
So we gain some and we lose some, but we want to wish her the best because she's done a fine job for us. And, of course, you know that we count on lobbyists to help us understand the ins and outs and the unintended consequences and the consequences and all that. So we wish Emily well. Members, we have two bills before us today, both of which will be laying over for possible inclusion in another bill. And so we welcome to our committee our Chair of Ways and Means, Representative Holberg, and I will move House File 2329 to be before the committee, and also members move Amendment A2. Representative Holberg, would you explain the A2 amendment, please?
Certainly, Madam Chair, and thank you for you and your committee's time this morning. The A2 amendment attempts to address some concerns, making this a little more workable for the School Board Association. There's a grammatical change as well, in that we don't want this to be a burdensome process for our schools, and this would allow for transfer students, if they had got it at a different grade level, another school, to be exempt, and it clarifies the enacting date, and let's see, and then there's a grammatical correction as well.
Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Holberg, please explain 2329 for us. This, members, is a bill for CPR training and instruction in our schools.
And Madam Chair, currently it's, as you'll see in first couple lines of the bill, the policy around this is that school districts are encouraged to do this. This would make it a requirement that at least once in the 7th through 12th time frame, a student would have a 30-minute CPR training program. This has gotten very easily to accomplish, which you'll hear from the testifiers, and that there's kits, etc. We're trying to not place an undue burden or mandate on the schools, and that this is should not require any additional expense of materials. And in fact, from my perspective, in the best model would involve local firemen, policemen, or maybe a healthcare clinic that could come in and interact with the kids and provide this experience. So with that, I know your time's short this morning. If there's not big questions right now, I think if we go through the testifiers, then at the end, if there's additional questions.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. We will hear from your testifiers, and then we'll have questions, members. And I think you have your first testifier at the table. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Justin Bell. I'm with the American Heart Association. And much like Representative Holberg said, this is a bill that sort of clarifies what's happening in state law on an encouragement level and makes it a requirement to include a one-time 30-minute CPR training for students at some point between grades 7 and 12. We've taken good care to try to allow this to happen as flexibly as possible for schools. We believe that about 50% of schools do this already. We wanted to take great care also to make sure that we wouldn't mess up anything that school districts are doing well now. We have a few different testifiers that can speak to the importance of the bill and the effort, so I think we'll just sort of move through those as quickly as we possibly can.
Thank you, Mr. Bell.
And Jamie Ledone.
Do you want to introduce the first testifier?
Yes. Our first testifier is Jamie Ledone.
Welcome to the testifying table. Please say your name for the record and then begin.
My name is Jamie Lalonde, and I'm here today because I'm one of the lucky 8% that has survived a sudden cardiac arrest. Mine happened when I was 18 at the Mall of America while working at Forever 21. Nobody around me knew to start CPR once I collapsed, and they called mall security, who was there in 5 minutes, and they started CPR. And 2 minutes later, Bloomington police showed up, shocked me with an AED twice. I was brought to Fairview Southdale Hospital, and they ran a bunch of tests, transferred me to U of M Hospital, ran more tests. They could not tell me why it happened to me. I was healthy. I got to thinking that I was around a bunch of 16 to 20-year-olds, and nobody knew how to perform CPR, and I realized that I wouldn't have been able to do it either. So that's why I am helping the American Heart Association make sure all high school students get one-time CPR training. If someone you love suffered a cardiac arrest, wouldn't you want to increase the chances of somebody around them knowing what to do? By simply taking 30 minutes one time to teach kids CPR, they could end up saving someone's life, and I'm alive because somebody around me knew how to do CPR.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lalonde. The next testifier, please. And please stay around in case there are questions for you later. Welcome to the testifying table. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Dale Wakasugi. I'm a longtime resident of Woodbury. And in 2007, while refereeing a boys' basketball game at Fridley High School, I went down with sudden cardiac arrest. And with the instant response from several bystanders, including a 16-year-old high school student, they did 3 rounds of CPR on me and no response. I was pretty much dead. And somebody grabbed an AED, automated defibrillator, and one shock and brought me back. And I'm here today as a member also of the Minnesota Sudden Cardiac Arrest Survivors Network, and I would urge you to pass this bill because the key rescuer in my save was a 16-year-old high school student who learned CPR 3 weeks prior to that in her high school health class. And as was mentioned earlier, this is not going to be an extra expense to the schools. It's easy to teach and easy to learn, and it doesn't take much time. So it could be a life-saving technique that could one day be one of the members in the chambers here today that they could save. So I would urge you to pass this bill, and that's my story. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wakasugi, and we are glad to have you with us. And please stay around in case we have questions for you. The next testifier. Please say your name for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Kim Harkins. I'm with the Minnesota Resuscitation Consortium at the University of Minnesota. The consortium is a project of Medtronic's Heart Rescue grant. We are tasked with the goal of improving survival from sudden cardiac arrest by 50% in the next 5 years. One of our objectives is partnering with local EMS, local fire, hospitals, as well as bystander efforts through schools, community efforts, and initiatives to increase the number of people that know how to do CPR. So we are working with the American Heart Association to help them provide some of those resources to schools to ensure that it will be no additional burden on a school district for equipment, for resources. As we work through the state of Minnesota, and this is a statewide effort, we are making connections in all of areas of Minnesota with those local fire departments who one of their major goals is to go out and do CPR training and to help bystanders. Because, of course, as an EMS professional myself, we know that when we arrive, if we don't have bystanders doing CPR, the chance of survival is significantly diminished. In fact, bystander CPR can increase survival by, it can double if not triple it. High school students are a great area for us to be working with because they are a captive audience. They're already there to learn, so adding this bill where they would be learning CPR can make a big difference, especially in some of our outlying areas of Minnesota where response is sometimes more difficult. So I think this is a wonderful idea, and we hope that we can support the American Heart Association as well as school districts, the Red Cross, all the agencies out there already teaching to provide the resources to get this done.
Thank you very much, Ms. Harkins. The next testifier. Welcome to our committee. You say your name for the record and begin.
Anthony Carr, Business Account Specialist for American Red Cross. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for an opportunity to speak. We truly do strongly support this bill. We feel being an organization that is the saving lives through our disaster relief, through blood, as well as through our health and safety training. We truly believe that our youth in our schools definitely should be reading, writing, and learning resuscitation. So we really like to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carr. And please stay around in case there are questions for you later. And I guess we have one or two more testifiers, too. Welcome to the testifying table. Please say your name for the record and begin to testify.
Hello, I'm Natasha Fleischman, and I am here as part of the Advocacy Committee for the American Heart Association. And I'm here to tell you that I was 33 when I died. My heart stopped while I was at work. I had two little boys at home. They did a bystander did CPR on me, and that is the reason I'm alive today. It took the fire department 5 shocks to get my heart started again. And since that time, my heart has stopped 2 more times, but I now have an implanted defibrillator. But I'm also here because since surviving sudden cardiac arrest 10 years ago, I've been elected twice to the Stillwater School Board. And generally, we as school board members are against all additional mandates that come from the state. And I have butted heads a few times with some of the legislation the American Heart Association wants to do because they're putting undue mandates onto schools, but on this one, I'm fully supportive. And I've worked with the American Heart Association to minimize costs to school districts. They're only asking for 30 minutes of time to teach this important life-saving skill. So I would love to see this go forward and see how many more lives we can save in Minnesota.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fleischman. And again, please stay around in case there's a question for you. Are there others who are here in support of this provision?
Madam Chair, I believe that's all that we have for support, but I do know that there are people that want to express some concerns.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Now we go to those who have concerns. So please come to the table and identify yourself and let us know about the concerns.
Madam Chair, my name is Kirk Schneider, and I'm on staff with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and a great segue from the prior witness on issues of mandates. And as you know, as I've shared with committee before, it's been very clear from our membership about issues require districts to do additional duties beyond what is already required of them. And so I think a couple issues you need to think about is as I read this bill, is how much, if any, is there going to be additional training required for staff? And I think that's something that it's not clear of. Obviously, when I first read the bill, I looked at this and I said, well, this is what happens in districts now. I mean, if you have a health instructor, a FIAD instructor who may not be certified, they generally reach out to the community, the local EMT or the fire department to come in and provide those training components. And I think the one of the issues also for us is that one of the last bastions of locally developed standards are your health standards, and we're holding on to those as much as we can. I'm afraid that once we get into this piece of adding CPR, is the next piece going to be how to use an EpiPen? And I just think that perhaps we may be setting a precedent here that potentially we could be going down a path where we will have these issues coming up again and again. And I think the piece about the length of instruction also is one of those that we're concerned about. While you talk about 30 minutes, I don't have any idea how long that's going to be. But as a health instructor or an administrator, I think you've got to calculate those things. And if you're doing a general session, I mean, it takes you 20 minutes or 30 minutes to get the kids into the cafeteria or the gym to even start the process. And I'm not sure what – not an expert on CPR training, but I think one of the things that – what are we going to get for the 30 minutes that we've been told about? Are we going to get a fully certified student, or are we just going to get an introduction to it? What exactly is going to be an outcome from that? And so I think one of the things that's important for school districts at any time is to reach out to their communities and get volunteer supports. I mean, all of that pays off in the long run for school districts, whether they're going out for referendums or building issues. So I think that as much as we can reach out, we do. And I'll be around for any questions. I'll turn it over to Mr. Walseth.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schneiderwin. Welcome, Mr. Walseth. Right. Please say your name for the record. And
Madam Chair, Member Sam Walseth. I represent rural school districts, about 140 across the state of Minnesota, and it is a big state. And I know it's nice that the Heart Association and Red Cross are available to provide these trainings, but it's a 700-mile round trip to the Canadian border and back to the Twin Cities. I visited 51 schools this September and logged 4,000 miles, and I barely put a dent in getting around this great state of ours. I think we feel a little sheepish being up here today. You don't want to be the merchants of death in committee saying let's oppose Representative Holberg's bill. But fundamentally, this bill does change the status to making the school district the provider of CPR, and I think that's a fundamental change that's going to be very problematic for small rural districts when you're talking about having 2.5, 3.5, 4 administrative staff, and who are we going to train in that district and find the time. I think if the bill were structured a little different to make sure that schools were providing time and space for the Red Cross and Heart Association to come in to make sure that we're working in partnership with those folks, that's a little different requirement. But as structured today, it does put the onus on the district to be the provider of the training, and that's we've got a lot of work to do that this committee and others have assigned to us by way of math, graduation standards, reading, writing, all the basics in academics, and it's just difficult to find the additional time. Parents want their kids to either get into sports outside of time, and it's just one more thing to add. And I do want to make a note. I did receive CPR training myself, junior lifeguards, a long time ago. I think my skills are a little rusty, but that was a family choice. We did that through private swimming lessons, and I think there are other options for students and families to get that kind of a certification. So with that, Madam Chair, members, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Walseth. And so, members, we'll now take questions. And Representative Greiling, you have the first one. Is there someone you would like to come to the table?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I don't have a question. I just have a comment. And I'm obviously a co-author of this bill. I support it. But, I relate to all the arguments against it. These are the ones I was making against Representative Myra's bill when we had such a fast hearing in Representative Garofalo's committee. 2.5 minutes, I think, that we didn't even get to hear from Mr. Walseth or Mr. Schneider when they hadn't made it to the hearing room yet, nor had I. So it's always a question of where do we draw the line. I did not support mandating FIED that either, like the school board member, but I am also like the school board member here thinking, we do have to draw the line somewhere. It's not a either or, it's a continuum, and where is it a small enough mandate but important enough to actually make that step? And I strongly believe this bill is one of those, and the testifiers spoke for themselves, so I won't repeat the importance.
Thank you, Representative Greiling. Representative Holberg, any comment on that? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm glad Mr. Walseth and Mr. Snyderman are here, because I've told them and others in the past that I would not be voting for unfunded mandates on schools. So, but to vote against this bill is like voting against the American flag. And even though I'm not so worried about November coming up, I don't want to be on record to be against apple pie. So I'm going to be voting for it, and I watched part of the Republican debate last night, and a former senator from Pennsylvania was defending some of his votes and being accused of not being totally pure, and his argument was he had to vote with the team, and I see some of my team members here as co-authors of the bill, so I will plead that I'm voting with the team today. But again, we are putting mandates, and all of them are thought of as good by authors, and this one, of course, is who can vote against the American Heart Association. But I do it with a little protest. It ought to have been funded. Thank you, ma'am.
Representative Benson, we're laying this over so you won't have to vote at this time.
Oh, good.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So you're with the team. Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to say thank you to my Woodbury residents over there, Dale and Justin. Justin came to me with this idea a couple of months ago in Woodbury, and, you know, that was one of the first questions I said, oh, this sounds like a mandate. Where's the funding coming from? You know, we have no money. And he assured me, and he can maybe talk to this, I don't know, about the funding. As I understand, it's going to be donations.
Ms. Harkins, welcome.
I don't know who has the answer, but I did ask that question because that's always one of my first concerns.
Thank you. Ms. Harkins can answer that. Please say your name for the record again, please.
Kim Harkins from the Minnesota Resuscitation Consortium. I'd be glad to answer those questions about funding. I think that it's absolutely a concern. I was a teacher. I spent several years working at Spring Lake Park and Osseo School District, so I do understand the effort it takes sometimes to implement something new. However, because this is something that is so easy to do and is already being done at so many professional levels, the equipment that's needed to do the training is already available. It's available in almost every community. I have been training in CPR for over 20 years, and I can't tell you that I've ever been anywhere that didn't have equipment to do the training. By providing resources to the school and those community resources, I think many of the school districts are going to find that they have equipment and resources in their community that they never knew they had. The other thing that the MRC is working on, and we've been working with groups such as the Survivors Network and Parent Heart Watch, to develop some training kits that are very simple kits that have mannequins, simple videos, the short 30-minute training that almost anybody could practically check out of a library and learn how to do CPR. These kits we are putting together and are working on ways to provide them to school districts who are absolutely not finding the community means to implement this in their district. The kits have 10-plus mannequins, so they would be able to use them in a classroom setting for multiple groups or multiple students. And we hope to be able to provide these to districts who, like I said, can't find those community connections.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you. I know that in our area, the Woodbury Public Safety Department is very actively involved and had an open house a couple weeks ago. One other question, and I'm not sure who would answer this, but I had comments at that Woodbury open house and also another middle schooler in my office just the other day. I'm wondering if middle school is too young to do this because some of the kids aren't. They're kind of silly. Like one of them in my office the other day said, "Ooh, it'd be kind of gross. I wouldn't want to do that." You know, it might become more of a burden for the teachers, especially they've got 30 minutes to try to settle down goofy middle schoolers. Sorry,
Representative Hulberg
and Madam Chair and Representative Kiefer. The bill allows the school board to pick at what grade level. So if a particular school board thought their middle schoolers were too silly. Yeah. They could make that call.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Benson made some of the comments that I did. This is a difficult bill because it's a great thing to do. And I think, as you can tell, we moved ahead a few years ago saying encouraged to. And I guess I'm going to advocate that we keep that unless we're putting funding and resources into the classroom, not because I don't think it's important. It's very, very important. And I'm one of the rusty ones that you should get a training here at the Capitol. So some of us that had those courses a number of years ago can be up to date. But I would just say it's not just the FIED bill that we've been very careful in this committee to not mandate. I look back to one of my freshman bills, parent involvement. Something as critical, I can't believe, you know, school districts may have a policy on parent involvement rather than must, because we were being so very careful that in these tough economic times, we did not mandate something additional to the schools. And we've been hearing a number of mandate bills this year, and I guess I'm just cautioning, while this is a very, very important topic, that we are very careful. And I'm going to say it again, and I'll keep saying it, having met with two consortiums of superintendents from southern Minnesota, both of them, their top priority is please don't give us any new mandates without resources because we are struggling right now. So while I'm completely sympathetic, I'm not sure this is the best time to do this to schools, though I'm, you know, my heart, like Representative Benson said, you know, you want to do the right thing. I'm just not sure this is the right time to do the right thing.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I didn't have any questions a minute ago, but then Representative Benson said he watched the Republican debate last night. Actually, I have a lot of questions now.
I have a lot of questions.
Sure you do. Yeah. But this is a mandate, as we've talked about. How many other states do this, mandate it? And both before and after enactment, has this actually been proven to save lives?
Representative Hulberg.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure as far as the number of states, whether or not they have the mandate, but I just like to make the point, we tried to make this as user-friendly, and they wouldn't have to buy textbooks. They wouldn't have to buy materials. The comment from the schools relative to maybe just mandating time and place. I mean, as this bill was presented to me, I never viewed this as being mainly being done by teachers. I saw the value in having the police departments, fire departments, health professionals in the community interacting with the students in the schools and as a preferred model for this. So maybe Mr. Bell has something to add on that.
Mr. Bell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To answer your question, Representative Barrett, currently there are two states in the country, Iowa and Alabama, that require it. It's something that is being worked on in almost all 50 states right now this year. And there's not, it's too new to point specifically to this bill and this policy priority saving lives, but the data that we're pointing at is the areas of the country that have higher sudden cardiac arrest survival rates are the areas in the country that coincidentally have better bases of trained folks. So you'll hear the consortium talk often about Seattle, Washington, as somewhere that has a higher percentage of their population trained in bystander CPR and a higher survival rate. Even in our state, Hennepin County has a higher survival rate because of more activities around CPR training.
Representative Barrett.
And just a quick follow-up. Why schools? Why not anyone who wants to get a driver's license or goes to a basketball game or goes shopping at a grocery store? Why are we targeting a certain population when there's a large population over the age 18 who are not requiring it for?
Mr. Bell.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Barrett. That's a great question, and we're not, it's not like we've stopped those efforts. Those efforts are ongoing to community members at large. As Ms. Harkins mentioned before, high school students are at an age that are ready to learn. They're a captive audience. It's just part of the tool that we can use to just increase the amount of folks that are trained in bystander CPR. And it's a life skill that students can carry with them through the, you know, through the rest of their lives.
Mr. Bell, to what extent do you market this program across the state to school districts? Do you send them all literature so they know that they're encouraged to do this, as Representative Mariani put in law a few years ago?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's something that's marketed through a bunch of different means through the Heart Association. Our activities with schools involve other fundraisers that we do. We have a Jump Rope for Heart program, and the CPR initiative is sort of attached to that as an education piece. There's some basic education that goes out to school districts and just sort of advocates the easy products that are available, the CPR Anytime class, and how easy that is to use and how it's a DVD instruction. One of the concerns from that we heard today was that this would require more staff training to be able to teach CPR, and that's not necessarily the case. The kits themselves come with DVDs to walk through, and the important part is just walking through the psychomotor component that actually doing chest compressions, and so teachers don't necessarily have to be particularly trained to do this when that comes in the materials.
So another question, Mr. Bell. Are any of the school districts who are doing this on a voluntary basis, using their National Honor Society or their student council to, like they do with blood mobiles, bring in the trainers and let the students learn from them? Do you know of any of that going on?
Madam Chair, I don't know how they're using their Honor Society or student councils to do that. I do know that, according to our internal polling of the schools that do it now, the vast majority utilize these community resources, as Representative Hulberg has pointed out. The bulk of schools out there do it by engaging their local EMS, their local fire departments, and come in to make it an activity.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Representative Keel, last question.
My questions got answered. Representative Hulberg said, reiterated that teachers are not required to have instruction in this. However, I wanted to share with you, when the Heart Association came to me with this bill, I too, being a former school board member, was reticent to require another mandate, so I did some calling. Now, my larger schools, which in the metropolitan area would be still considered small, I think my largest school has got 1,500 students in it entirely. I called one of them, and they do that. They have the health and nursing service come in and have it taught. I called a really small school and found out the school board member, who was an EMT instructor, they've got all the equipment. They managed to purchase it at a discount from a former college. And they teach it to almost all of their students. And they actually have an AED practice, so those students learn it. So I was glad to hear that we are making it a priority. I wrestle with the mandate, but I do think this is a very important thing our students learn, along with, I'm thinking I should learn it too. I might need it.
Thank you. Representative Holberg, closing comments.
Well, Madam Chair, and I understand this is being laid over, and we'll continue to talk, and I've heard loud and clear the mandate issue. I understand it, but I do believe that this will save lives, and I don't believe that it's overburdensome in the fact that there are a lot of resources in the community that not only are able but are excited about the opportunity to be able to do this with the students.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. With that, I'll renew the motion that House File 2329, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in another bill. Thank you very much, Chair. Representative Holberg, and all of you who came to testify, thank you very much for telling your stories. Members, the next bill on our agenda is House File 2293, Representative Dabney, and Prone Restraint.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney, I will move 2293 to be before the committee, and I believe you have the H2 amendment. So, members, I will move the H2293 H2 amendment. Will you explain your amendment, please, Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I do have an oral amendment, if you would indulge. The A2 members narrows and clarifies the definition of prone restraint in a couple of places on the amendment. Establishes an age threshold below which prone restraint may not be used in the schools, and increases the prohibitions on and structures around prone restraint in the interest of student safety.
Representative Dabney, would you move your oral amendment, please?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. On the bill, House File 2293, lines 2.24 and 2.25, after the word department, strike "or on a district's restrictive procedure documentation form." And what this does, members, is assure the public that we have more consistency in the reporting of data so that the public and stakeholder groups can better understand the data that's coming from school districts. And hopefully then we can make better decisions going forward because we have consistent reporting.
And I'm just going to check. Ms. Larson, do you have that? Would you repeat it for us, please?
Madam Chair, members, Representative Dabney is proposing an oral amendment, but it's to the bill, not to the A2 amendment.
Excuse me. So then let's hold off. Is there further discussion to the A2 amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The A2 amendment is adopted. Now we'll deal with the oral amendment, which is to the main part of the bill. Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Dabney requested an oral amendment to House File 2293 as introduced. On page 2, line 24, strike "or on a district's restrictive." On page 2, line 25, strike "procedure documentation form."
And Ms. Larson, does the "and" stay then, or did you delete the "or" as well? On line 224.
Madam Chair, members, the "and" connects the items 1 through 5.
So
after the semicolon?
So the oral amendment on 224 began with "or"?
That's correct.
I'm sorry, I had missed that. Members, any questions about the oral amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of the oral amendment on lines 224 and 225 on the bill itself, 2293, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The motion carries and the oral amendment is adopted. Two-year bill, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, the 2011 Education Omnibus Bill included language, included provision to allow school districts to use prone restraint through August 1st of this year for student and staff safety reasons. It limited the use of prone restraint, however, to being used by staff who'd received specific training. That training has to be reported to the Department of Education. A list of trained staff has to be provided to the department. Any use of prone restraint has to be reported again to the department within 5 working days of the event, and only can be used after the district has reviewed the student's medical and psychological situation for any contraindications. And then that legislation also required that the department report back to the chairs of the education committees in the two bodies by February 1st of this year. I believe many of you have been provided copies of the department's report on the 5 months of data that they were able to ascertain previous to the report. The legislation before you, as amended, puts some more structure around the use of prone restraint in the interest of student and staff safety, and extends for one more year that prohibition, looking to work with districts on finding ways to eliminate prone restraint in an orderly way that maintains the safety of staff and students in the settings where it is used. With me today are several individuals in support of the bill. Ms. Dozeland is representing the intermediate school districts who operate in the metropolitan area, and perhaps we'll start with her.
Welcome, Ms. Dozeland.
Or not. Okay.
No.
Or instead, we'll start with Ms. Aberholden from the National Association of the Mentally Ill of Minnesota.
Welcome, Ms. Aberholden, and please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sue Aberholden, NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness. I'd like to put this bill into context so that you understand how far we've come. As noted in the department's report, there was a task force that met to revise the state rules on this subject, but they couldn't come to any agreement. Because of the problems that we heard, such as their use in a non-emergency situation, long hours in seclusion, NAMI then invited experts from both schools and the mental health community to work to create a community consensus for restricting the use of seclusion and restraint procedures in the schools. We researched other states, but the basis of our discussion was what we permitted in mental health programs for children. In addition to continuing to support school districts to use positive behavioral interventions and supports, there was a consensus created to propose legislation that defined emergency seclusion and restraints, permitted their use only in an emergency when the child is in danger of hurting themselves or others or major property damage, permitted their use only by trained staff, allowed schools to plan for emergencies so they could talk about it in the IEP, required schools to determine how to document, report, and review the use of seclusion restraints, and it prohibited certain actions or procedures. Legislation was introduced and passed during the 2009 legislative session that reflected this consensus. While it was not certainly in our eyes a perfect bill, we believed it was a significant step forward. It was more than we had, and it contained the key elements. And frankly, it's not often that you have NAMI and the School Board Association holding hands singing Kumbaya. We gave school districts 2 years to prepare for its implementation, knowing that there would be a great deal of staff training needed and other work before it went into effect on August 1st, 2011. Ms. Dozeland will talk about what happened last sessions in terms of a last-minute agreement to clarify that prone restraints would be allowed to be used for 1 year and those restraints could not restrict breathing, but I want to talk about why NAMI is supporting this bill. The Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, which has a nationwide effort to reduce the use of seclusion and restraints on children and adults with mental illnesses in all settings, states that it takes a planned effort, including data collection and analysis, strategies for organizational change, staff training, risk assessment, debriefing, and an adequate number of staff for any organization to move towards zero use of seclusion and restraints. NAMI does not like prone restraints, and we would like to see their use discontinued. But I remind committee members that our law for schools has only been in place for 7 months. We are at the beginning of this effort. It takes time, commitment, and resources to reduce and eliminate them. The MDE report is the first of its kind in our state, and there are many more questions than answers. In our discussions, particularly with the intermediate districts, we have seen a concentrated effort to train staff, use debriefing sessions, and analyze the data in order to try to do things differently. This is the first time we have collected district data on the use of seclusion restraints and statewide data on the use of prone restraints. So while the use of prone restraints is higher than expected, we have no comparison. We have no idea how much it was used before. In addition, with so few months of implementation, we didn't expect the new tools that staff have learned to be second nature. And even in schools where it is high, so what? We didn't provide any teeth in the law, any opportunity for MDE to intervene when they are used in non-emergency situations, or money for training or technical assistance. Because a high percentage of children who had prone restraints used on them were in the EBD category, NAMI has a real concern about what happens to these children, many of whom have serious mental illnesses, and some who have CASI scores that would qualify them for day or residential treatment. We are genuinely worried about unintended consequences, such as more children being placed on homebound because the intermediates cannot keep them or their staff safe in school, more children diverted to day treatment where we already have problems regarding payment and transportation, increased use of police who do not have training on the use of prone restraints, and it will result in more children or some children ending up in the juvenile justice system, and increased use of reasonable force, which is allowed under education statutes and for which they don't have the same reporting requirements. The solution isn't to ban restraints at this time, as much as I don't like them. It is to continue to develop alternatives, and I would go a step further, a comprehensive plan. It's not just training of school staff. It's a more robust mental health system that provides for more collaboration between schools and intensive treatment options. More school-linked mental health services so children can obtain clinical services that are easily accessible and where they are more likely to complete treatment. Streamlining the funding streams for education and transportation services for day treatment and only allowing true clinical day treatment programs to call themselves a day treatment program. Allowing for children in day treatment and residential treatment programs to have access to year-long education so they aren't so behind when they return to school, and being behind and facing stressful tests and educational challenges only exacerbates the problem. Encouraging schools to refer children earlier to mental health services without worrying they will be financially responsible. Supporting programs that teach social and emotional learning. And providing MDE with staff time and training money so that they can actually provide technical assistance to the schools that are higher users of seclusion and restraint. NAMI worked hard in 2008 and 2009 to create a community consensus and to develop and pass a bill because we care about what happens to children, particularly those who live with a mental illness. The MDE report only came out this month, and there has not been an opportunity to again bring everyone together to create a consensus about how to move forward. NAMI is in the process, with the use of a CURA intern, of surveying schools on the implementation of this recent law. And by extending the deadline for only 1 year, we keep the pressure on to create a comprehensive plan. We know it's our kids who have these procedures used on them, our kids who make up 70% of the juvenile justice system, our kids who have one of the highest dropout rates, and our kids whose mental health needs are not nearly addressed as they should be. Our position was not taken lightly. But 8 months ago, we had nothing, and now we have a beginning. We want our children in school and in their family homes. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Aberhold, and that was an excellent presentation, and we have Representative Dabney, of course, to thank for having carried this this very important legislation over the years. I really appreciate that he was willing to carry this, because it takes some understanding of what's happened in the past and looking to the future. Ms. Dozeland, please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dozeland, and I represent the intermediate school districts. I'm going to be brief because I want you to hear from the folks in school districts to get a kind of understanding of some of the issues they face. But I wanted to just provide, again, some further context. One, why didn't you hear this bill last session? There's not clarity in the statute about whether or not prone restraint can be used. On May 11th of last year, the department sent an email to special ed directors informing them that under the statute, the use of prone restraints was not permitted. However, the statute states that it prohibits physical holding that restricts or impairs a child's ability to breathe. It does not specifically say that prone restraint is prohibited. Due to the nature of the timing of the decision by the department, we obviously worked very quickly with NAMI and other stakeholders, although in the end it was NAMI who we worked most directly with, to come up with a two-year extension. What passed was a one-year extension during the special session. Over the course of the interim, the intermediate special ed directors and the different advocacy organizations, of which included NAMI, the Disability Law Center, PACER, ARC, and representatives from the Department of Education, to the extent possible, all folks were at the table to try to see if we could reach a compromise. In the end, what the agreement was that we would ask for an extension for one more year and continue to review this this procedure. So I appreciate the folks that are participating in the meetings, and I understand why we were not able to reach an agreement. I hope that we can continue to discuss this issue, and I just hope that the members of the committee, once you hear the reasons why we're requesting the extension, that this is something that the body can support. Thanks for your time, and I'm just going to let you hear from the intermediates.
Thank you, Ms. Dosland. And we have representatives from the intermediate. Ms. Lewandowski, I know you're here. And before she begins, we have in the audience, I see some FFA members and perhaps their teacher. So would you stand, please? And, sir, would you tell us from where your students come? And then, students, would you say your names for us? And, sir, would you make sure you tell us whether you teach ag education or, you know, what your course load is?
Hi, my name is Carl Ockery. I'm from Vermont, State Chapter from Minnesota. I am an agricultural education instructor, and agricultural sciences as well. And my students are here.
Please say your name, students. Well, welcome, and this is FFA Day, right?
That's correct.
Thank you very much. And I don't think Representative Murdoch is here. He's ill, and I think he would be your rep.
Yes,
well, I hope he's better and can meet with you, but he was ill this morning, so he's excused. Thank you very much for coming, and I hope you understand the discussion we're having about a technique that can be used or has been used with especially our special needs students, and as you heard, Ms. Aberholden refer with our mentally ill. Welcome to the committee, Superintendent Lewandowski, and please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sandra Lewandowski. I'm the superintendent of Intermediate School District 287 on the west side of the metro area, and Intermediate 287 is one of three intermediate districts in the state. One of our core missions has been to provide educational day programs for students who have significant special education needs, and we are highly committed to the quality program that results in us often having wait lists in our special education day programs. However, students in these programs have needs that are often not well understood by many citizens in our community. For example, last year as a superintendent, we experienced a new situation for our intermediate. We had a 13-year-old student sexually assault one of our staff in the classroom during the day. In a separate visit to one of my schools, I happened to walk in on a situation where an 18-year-old student had just tried to commit suicide by jumping over a second floor railing in one of our buildings. Each day, we have staff who are hit, bit, and spit upon in our programs. At the same time, we recognize the significant mental illness and disabilities that these students have and are certainly in concert with many of the things represented by NAMI. In early January, I represented all three intermediate districts at a legislative forum at the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. In fact, we represented a legislative platform item on AMSD's platform this year. My message to legislators that day was because of a number of factors external to school districts, public education was increasingly becoming the provider and payer for students who had extraordinary behavioral needs. Educationally, we know that these students have significant special education needs. However, in order to address these educational needs, public schools must start first with the behavioral and mental health issues that these students walk through our doors with them each day. This shift of responsibility has resulted in schools not only reaching a tipping point in our ability to keep students and staff safe, it has also meant that public schools are increasingly becoming the payer of last resort for what has previously been public safety and mental health services provided under other entities. Staff in our school districts are asked to implement very sophisticated educational strategies. Increasingly, they are asked to implement equally sophisticated behavioral and mental health interventions. Safety needs are paramount every day in my district, in every building and every classroom. I've brought a short 2-minute clip that I'd ask the chair if we could dim the lights and show. It is from one of our security cameras in one of my buildings. My hope is that it shows you an example of our reality and the increasing challenge of keeping students and staff safe within each of our school days. The particular building that this clip comes from is a secondary program. It has about 100 students, and for that 100 students, we contract 2 full-time police officers to the cost of about $150,000, and we have a staff ratio of about 1 staff person for each 3 students. All of our staff are extensively trained. I'll talk you through the video simply because it's a little bit fuzzy, and I want to give you a context, if I may, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Superintendent. Go right ahead.
We'll start the video. This is in our cafeteria, and you'll see that there are a number of individuals here. About half the individuals are staff and about half are students. You'll see a young man in a white T-shirt on the far right-hand side of the screen. He's been verbally provoked by another student on the other side of the cafeteria. Staff work to de-escalate his behavior, and indeed, he does sit down momentarily. You'll see the staff are all interacting with the students in an attempt to keep a calm and de-escalated environment. At one point, the verbal provocation continues, and the student will again, on the right-hand side, stand up and begin to interact with the student on the far left-hand side, grabbing a chair, and the chair slinging begins. Staff are physically and verbally trying to de-escalate the situation. You'll see it escalates significantly with multiple numbers of staff being involved. As this scene continues, we have other staff rushing in from the other part of the building to back up the staff in the cafeteria. What you're going to see right here on the right-hand side is a police officer in plain clothes who's now put the student in a police-approved kind of restraint, while the rest of the staff are, again, trying to intervene to get everybody to a safe position. We have a probation officer standing in the middle of the cafeteria at this point in the blue jeans. He's coming to help, and what you'll see coming from the left is actually a second police officer who has come to the scene. So I bring you this video to show what our reality is. We have many other kinds of realities and many other kinds of students who have different profiles. But my point is to say to you, committee members, that these students come with extraordinary disabilities and they come with extensive special education legal rights. They do deserve to have their educational, psychological, and behavior needs met in a way that's consistent with evidence-based practices in a dignified and safe manner. The prone restraint legislation that's before you today is a piece of a much larger and needed policy discussion, and I would ask the committee to address this particular bill, this discrete legislation, in light of that larger policy issue. And with that, I would turn it to our Executive Director of Mental Health Partnerships and ask her to introduce herself, if I may, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you. Please welcome to the committee and say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. My name is Dr. Charlene Michael-Best, and I am the Executive Director of Mental Health and Partnerships in Intermediate District 287. And I am here as a mental health professional who works in the schools, so that is my perspective. First of all, I'd like to preface my remarks by saying that none of us in the school system want to use prone restraint. It's our very last resort. We try to use many other methods prior to getting to any kind of physical or seclusion intervention with students. I'd like to give you some examples of what we do in the intermediate school districts. We have many prevention and early intervention programs. We have evidence-based programs that teach social-emotional learning skills to students. And by the way, if you weren't aware, social-emotional learning instruction actually increases academic achievement among students and improves attendance rates and school attachment. So those are some of the interventions that we use. We also teach students what they don't know about pro-social behavior, help them learn how to relax, to concentrate, to pay attention, to engage in some problem-solving skills with their peers. All of this leads to better self-regulation, and this is really our goal, to have positive behavior interventions and supports prior to students getting to the point where we need to have some sort of intervention. That said, many of our students have significant mental health disorders. They were 2 years ago in residential facilities oftentimes. So they are students who come from very restrictive environments, and we are seeing more and more the trend to take students out of those restrictive settings and to send them to public schools. And in the end, we really do believe that this serves the students better and it leads to better outcomes. So in 287, what we have seen since we have been using trained prone restraint interventions and since we have been documenting and reporting those interventions is that we have had no student injuries. We've had about 100 prone restraints in our district. Many of our staff, unfortunately, have been injured in the process, but we do not have student injuries. I should also mention that these are staff who, despite receiving injuries, want to come to work every day, want to work with this challenging population, and find it their life's work, really, to intervene with students who have significant needs. Our concerns, if we cannot use prone restraint, are that we will end up in a system where there is no training, and that when there are emergency measures, we will have people who have a good Samaritan responsibility to intervene in a crisis. And when you have untrained people who mean well, physically intervening, there are bound to be injuries. And we have found, just comparing our past injuries with students compared to this past year, again, we had no student injuries using the prone restraint method. We are also concerned that we will have more police involvement because there will come a point when a child is very de-escalated and they're about to hurt themselves or others that we will have to call for law enforcement support. And once law enforcement enters the scene, educators have a mandate to back off. Once it's turned over to law enforcement, the consequences are out of our hands, and police intervention, especially from a physical perspective, is very different from how educators intervene physically with our students. We're also concerned about more 911 calls for ambulance services to take kids to psychiatric placements. The result of that kind of intervention is that they usually go to a hospital for perhaps a 24-hour hold, and then they are brought back to school. Perhaps there's been a medication adjustment, but then again, when they get to school, we cannot force students to take their medication, or can we adjust their medication, so we're kind of back in the same situation that we started in. We're also concerned, again, about more homebound instruction, about our staff needing to go out to homes and work with students because they will be unable to function in a public school setting. And then we're also concerned about community safety. We have students who may jump out of buses, students who will run out in front of cars. And sometimes and oftentimes when we intervene with students, it's to prevent them from hurting themselves. So I think that with the interventions that we've seen this past year, what we notice is that our staff are better trained. We have fewer injuries among students. We have no injuries among students. And we actually have a situation where we believe we have a safer environment in the schools. It's just like clockwork. Our team knows what to do, when to do it. The restraints tend to most of them last less than a minute, and a very few percentage, about 2.5% percent of our students have had a physical intervention in the nature of a prone restraint. So we have actually thought that the oversight has been a good thing, and we would like to continue with the protocol that we have in place to be able to get some more data and report to you in a year after August. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doctor. And we do we have another testifier? Welcome to the testifying table. Please say your name for the record and please begin.
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Melissa Shaler, and I'm coming to you as the Director of Intermediate School District 917, but also in my role as President of the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education. I think you've heard today that everyone can agree that a decrease in the use of restrictive procedures is our desired outcome. Minnesota school districts are seeking assistance to respond to increasingly challenging situations in which they find themselves. Part of the assistance is through implementation of emergency response. Other assistance includes implementation of strategies like positive behavior interventions and supports, and the involvement of monitoring and compliance staff with us to understand the situations that we face firsthand. We're really seeking some technical assistance. Prone restraint has been used for 20 students in Intermediate School District 917. Likely four of those students would not be able to be served without the emergency response available. So what that means for them is that they would likely be placed in a homebound situation where we would be serving them and educating them for a period of time each day in their home setting. Worker compensation claims for Intermediate School District 917 have increased fivefold over the last 3 years. This year we are on track for another increase in claims. The majority of our claims are due to physical aggression of students towards staff, and our staff training has increased. In the past, our initial training for crisis response was 8 hours. Now, our initial training for crisis response is 22 hours. MACE has sought a collaborative relationship with the Department of Education to implement restraint and seclusion. We met 5 times during the 2010-2011 school year in an effort to build that collaborative, supportive relationship. And I think it's only going to be through equal investment in a collaborative relationship that we will experience success for the students of Minnesota.
Thank you very much, Ms. Shaler. Do we have others who are in support? Because we're ready to take those with concerns. Welcome to the table. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Elaine Keefe, and I'm here on behalf of the Pacer Center. And we've really agonized over this, but we do support this bill. We oppose the use of prone restraints, and frankly, we found some of the information on the use of prone restraints in the MDE report pretty disturbing. It's clear that prone restraints are being used in situations that are not emergencies under the law. But we hear schools say they need more time to develop more tools and train their staff in other effective methods of protecting students. And so we think that this one-year extension with the additional definitions is a reasonable compromise, and we do support it.
Thank you very much. Are there others in support? MDE, welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members, Kevin McHenry from the Department of Education. We just wanted to just be on record here. Want to thank Representative Dabney for bringing this bill forward. We want to thank the advocates that have come forward discussing this issue today. I think we can all agree that we do share the goal of we'd like to eventually eliminate prone restraint, but we do want to make sure that our teachers and our students are as safe as possible. We look forward to continue working with the author and with the advocates in this mission to develop a comprehensive approach when looking at prone restraint and other restraining procedures to help eliminate prone restraint.
Mr. McHenry, has the department sent out any memos recently to try to clarify what we passed in legislation last year before we make any changes?
Madam Chair, members, the department, we haven't sent out any memos to my knowledge, and that was just clarified. We did actually just submit the report that you all have in front of you, and that's the latest that we put out.
Thank you, Mr. McHenry. Before you leave, let's go to a question for you. Representative Peterson, Sandra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've heard from the intermediate school districts who deal with the more intense cases that might use prone restraints. And I am curious about the training for K-12 special ed teachers. Are they also included in this legislation, and are they also getting that kind of training, and does this apply to them?
Mr. McHenry, I think he has an expert who can answer for
us. Yeah, I'm going to bring up Barb Case, who's our Director of Compliance and Monitoring.
Thank you, Mr. McHenry. Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Your name, please.
Oh, Barbara Case. The question was: Are all teachers
K-12? Are all K-12 teachers special ed? Yes.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. They're all trained, but they're not necessarily all trained in the use of prone restraint, and not all trained in the use of other restrictive procedures. If they are trained, they submit those training reports to the department, so that we keep a list of staff that the regular school districts or the intermediate school districts anticipate will be using these procedures. Before they use the procedures, they have to be trained, and they have to submit the report of the training to the department.
Representative Peterson, follow up.
Well, yeah. You know, even besides special education teachers, I think classroom teachers also should be aware of the implications of using prone restraint in the class. You know, they may confront this too. So is there any training just generally for teachers, for special ed? You're talking about teachers. It doesn't happen that often. At least they're not reporting that many cases, but it does happen. And so is that part of a requirement for the schools?
Ms. Case.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, I actually think that there's others in the room who are better able to speak to the teacher training, but I believe that all teachers are trained to a degree in positive behavior interventions and supports, and to a degree in other interventions that might be used with students, but not to the degree that but not to the degree that teachers need to be trained in if they're going to use restrictive procedures. But yes, I believe that it's part of a teacher competency in general. And Melissa?
Welcome back, Ms. Shaler.
Thank you. The question is, do the general ed teachers and do the special ed teachers receive training? And I think as part of this statute, they do lay out that, you know, that in order to implement a prone restraint and restrictive procedures, you do have to have training. Many of our school districts have provided training for their broad population of teachers, a general training, so that they understand the implications of the statute, because it's so different than what it has been in the past. So I can't say universally every single teacher in the state of Minnesota has had that training as part of that, but I do think that a large majority of districts have done large-scale training. St. Cloud Public Schools has done large-scale training, Lakeville Public Schools. Just to give you a sense, there is an awareness that hasn't been there in the past about restrictive procedures that is there to a greater extent now.
So, Ms. Shaler, is a regular ed teacher in K-12 free of liability if he or she must use some kind of restraint? Ms. Case, maybe you can answer that.
I'm sorry, I was actually concerned momentarily.
My question is, to what extent can a regular ed teacher use any of this? Because in our provision, the part of statute that we are amending, direction is on line 2.22. Prone restraints may be used by only be used by staff who have received specific training. And that's, of course, from the special ed statute. But do we know, Ms. Case, if it's used by regular ed? Maybe Ms. Aberholden knows.
We of course, it wouldn't have to be reported to us.
But it might be.
If other interventions are used, what does not have to be reported. It's the reporting mechanism is just the mechanism that's in this statute.
Correct, and that's for special ed.
And that's for special education.
Yes.
So if it's used in general education, it wouldn't be reported to the department.
That's not reported to you.
Ms. Aberholden, did you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to mention that there is the reasonable force statute, so
yes.
Saying in the schools,
yes.
If something, if you have to protect a child, you're okay. You don't okay. get.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
The pages were good enough to pass out the MDE, recent
Correct.
MDE report. I think if members look at page 13, they can see the incidence across the state of the use of prone restraint. And it's overwhelmingly the intermediates that are dealing with this population where it is used.
Thank you very much, Representative Dabney, for that reference. Members, that is page 13, where the district trained in and or using prone restraint is charted for us. Any other questions for Ms. Case, as long as she's here? Representative Depke.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ms. Case, for coming. I do have a question for you on it seems that the issue and the testifiers today, and by the way, thank you, Representative Dabney, for your hard work on this. I know how difficult it is to work to get legislation to have sort of peace in the valley. But Ms. Case, is there any a connection with the higher education for our teachers in training our special education teachers? What we heard testimony from Ms. Lindowski today, that these are situations that our special ed teachers in the intermediate districts are facing. It's the first time they've done that. They're struggling with it. They're having to bring in the police and things like that. Are we communicating and coordinating this kind of training in our higher levels of education for our special educators that are, this is the area they want to go in? Are we working with the higher ed schools at all on this issue?
Ms. Case.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Depke. I'm not the best person to speak to the teacher training, but yes, it's my understanding that the department is working with higher ed to a degree on the positive behavior interventions and supports and training, making sure that all teachers are trained in that regard.
Representative Depke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think it's something that we should explore. And as we go forward, I think this is a very good bill. I thank you, Representative Dabney, for bringing it forward. But I do think that higher ed connection is very important. If this is something new that our teachers are experiencing, we should be teaching them at the college level on this.
Ms. Case.
Madam Chair, Representative Depke, I think that the next time the department does a report, that would be a good addition, would be information responding to your question today.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. During the testimony, one of the testifiers indicated that there was a sixfold, I believe was the number, increase in injury to staff. And this issue of prone restraint, I suppose it goes all the way back to Dorothea Dix, who wrote things way back in the 1820s about the misuse of force against those who have these difficulties. So we don't want to go back to that, but I am concerned about whether or not there is a correlation between the reduction in the use of prone restraint and this sixfold increase in injury for staff. And do the testifiers have a strategy or proposals that not only can reduce the prone restraint practice, but also increase protection for staff? It seems that those numbers are pretty startling.
Ms. Case. Oh, Representative Dabney or Ms. Case, whoever.
Okay. As others come forward, Madam Chair, I think, Representative Benson, you hit exactly on the need for this extension at this time. Mm-hmm. I think we all have the same vision of the elimination of prone restraints in the schools. We need it. Time is needed for those settings that deal with these challenging students to develop the training and the experience and embedding that into their culture of other strategies, as well as working with those students so that they learn other ways of responding to whatever provocation they may be experiencing that leads to the sort of situations you saw in the videotape. So I think you just hit it on the head.
Dr. Michelbus, did you want to add something?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, committee members, the issue with the increase in staff injuries, in my view, is largely due to the increase in the needs of the students we are seeing. And in the last year or so, we've had a significant increase of students who have come from very restrictive settings who have had vests used to contain behavior or have given some sort of psychotropic intervention to calm their behavior. So we are now seeing a higher level of need among our students. The second point I would make is that after every incident, we do have a staff debriefing, and we do a procedural autopsy, so to speak, of what happened in the beginning of the event, what could we have done differently, and then we either give staff additional protective covering or additional strategies to help them with a similar situation in the future.
Representative Benson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up, if I may ask the doctor, do you feel that with this additional time or additional training, you can dramatically reduce the instances of injury to staff? I just think those kinds of numbers are intolerable. I don't think we want these young people to lose an opportunity, you know, to meet their potential. But at the same time, I don't see that we ought to expose staff to continued and unmitigated consequences of these violent acts either. I just don't think anybody in any kind of a workplace should be expected to suffer continual violence and injury. And so I'm just wondering, do you see strategies which will dramatically reduce those instances?
Dr. Michelbust.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I believe that our data collection procedures are going to help us make some decisions that will tailor our interventions so that we can prevent some of these injuries. So I'm convinced that we can reduce prone restraint. The other piece I would say, however, is that there are some students whose behavior is so dysregulated that we simply will not be able to maintain them in an environment such as they're in. So we do a thorough job of educating our teachers about what the potential consequences are of working in positions like this. We make sure that we take care of them and have a debriefing session and other protective measures. But I agree, we do not want our staff members to be injured. Certainly not coming to work to do the job of working with kids every day. But I do think that in some cases we are not going to be able to prevent that.
Thank you, Doctor. In the audience now we have my district here, the Foley FFA, and we have there a teacher and a school board member. Would you stand up and just very quickly say your names for us, starting with you, Al?
Al Stemper, I'm the FFA advisor and I'm
And next student, very quickly, your name? Just your first.
I'm Alicia Stemper. I'm a junior at Foley High School, and I'm the vice president of our office.
Thank you, vice president. Mr. Miller.
I'm Bob Miller. I'm a school board member.
Next student.
I'm Sandy Bartholomew, and I'm a sophomore.
I'm Katie Supple, and I'm also a senior, and I'm the president of the chapter.
Very good.
Good morning. I'm Amanda Cook. I'm a teaching candidate from the University of Minnesota.
Excellent.
I'm Connie Smithy, and I'm a senior.
Amelia Simmonsmeyer. I'm also a junior.
Thank you very much. For coming. They have a very fine teacher. He's just done a marvelous job with those students, and so thank you for visiting. I'm sorry, members, you know, when it's your own district, you want to show them off a little bit. But we need to go on to concerns, so Representative Greiling and Representative Woodard, if you would hold your questions, we need to hear from those with concerns. For the sake of the students, we're listening to a provision that would change the use of prone restraint and physical holding for special education students. And this now is word from those who are concerned. Welcome to the testifying table. Say your name, please, and begin.
Madam Chair and Representatives, I'm Steve Larson, the Senior Policy Director of the ARC Minnesota.
The ARC advocates for persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families, and we oppose the use of tone restraint. In MDE's recent report, it states on page 23 that 15 states specifically prohibit the use of tone restraint, which is defined as any restraint in which a child is held face down. So our question today is, why is Minnesota not one of those states? We wish the report would have included more information about how those states got to that position, and I think it would help our discussion today. Again, in the MDE report on page 7, it states that on December 1st, 2011, a settlement was reached between the state of Minnesota and plaintiffs in the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options lawsuit. And it states, pursuant to the settlement in the Mito case, programmatic use of prone restraint, among other types of restraint, are not allowed in similar DHS licensed facilities serving residents with developmental disabilities for the purpose of changing behavior through punishment. This prohibition is based in relevant part on the recognition that asphyxiation is a risk factor for the use of prone restraint. Again, that was on page 7. In 2009, comprehensive legislation was passed, and I want to thank the legislature for doing that, addressing the need for reducing the use of seclusion and restraint in Minnesota schools. The legislation went into effect on August 1, 2011. Near the end of the 2011 legislative session, there was a debate whether the 2009 legislation included a ban on the use of prone restraint in our schools. A compromise was reached and legislation passed to allow for one more year, and reporting requirements were established. And I think my contribution to that discussion last year was to put the one-year limit in the legislation, and we're glad that we did that. In MDE's report during this brief reporting period, prone restraint was used 592 times in emergency situations. Many of these were repetitive situations. We think this number is entirely too much. 38% of the students have autism spectrum disorders, and they have the greatest number of incidents, or the majority of those incidents. There is a strong consensus that we've heard today in the disability community that prone restraint should be eliminated, but there are differences about how we can achieve that goal. What is lacking is a plan. If our goal is to eliminate prone restraint, then there must be a plan to get there, and we contend a plan could be established very shortly and implemented during the next several months. Extending the use of prone restraint for one more year without a plan will not help us accomplish this goal. We suggest that this bill include a timetable and a plan for how we get to the elimination of prone restraint as soon as possible. And whether we need to establish a work group or a task force, a systematic plan needs to be developed to achieve this goal. As a result of the Mito lawsuit, DHS has established what is known as a Rule 40 Committee to address very similar issues. Minnesota, as we've heard today, is expanding its expertise in alternatives to prone restraint, and the Department of Human Services is also putting a substantial effort into that. We think we should combine that expertise from education community, human services, and the disability communities, get them to the table, and come up with a plan that we can implement in this year so that students and practitioners are not at further harm. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Larson. And, sir, say your name for the record.
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Stewart. Members, I'm Dan Stewart from the Disability Law Center. The Disability Law Center is a statewide project of legal aid. We're also the federally designated protection and advocacy organization of Minnesota. We receive federal funds to protect and advocate for individuals with disabilities across the age spectrum, but also across the disability spectrum. We're here today in opposition of the bill as it's in its present form. The primary reason for our opposition is because we believe that prone restraint is such a risky procedure that it should not continue. It is so risky because there are so many different variables that we can't predict and we can't control for. We simply don't know how many kids will be injured or harmed in all sorts of different horrible ways by the use of prone. The real problem from our perspective, and this is substantiated by the department's report, is with the sheer and astounding number of uses. We have 592 uses in about a 4.5 month period. And especially that's concerning because there are other forms of restraint and seclusion used on kids with disabilities. And this prone restraint is only supposed to be used as a last resort. So we've got to know that there are other forms of restraint and seclusion being used on these children. We also are very concerned about the number of repeated uses on the same student. This shows us that the use of prone doesn't stop the underlying behavior. If we can't stop the underlying behavior, we're only kicking the can down the road. We need to figure out a way to stop that behavior, and I think that's the goal shared by everyone here. There's also a concern about the racial disproportionate use of prone restraint, and that's in the department's report. We did see a video here today, and certainly there are many other stories about very difficult situations. Safety of students and staff is absolutely critical. That's a primary goal, and we need to make sure that the schools are safe for everyone. But again, the repeated use shows that the prone restraint is not stopping the underlying behavior. And ultimately, we need a way out. Let's not come back here next year if this continues. We have a lot of data. We have a lot of experience. We have other Minnesota schools that do not use prone restraint with the same type of population. There are other states that have banned prone. There are other facilities that don't use prone, either by a ban or by choice. We can figure out how to build cultures of no restraint. We can figure out with the expertise, with outside consultants, with the whole community trying to figure out a way to prevent and reduce the use of restraint and seclusion. I do agree with a number of the recommendations that Sue Aberholden and what the school district folks have said. Those are important, and certainly this legislation that Representative Dabney shepherded through in 2009 is very important, and it really increases the discussion over this very important issue. We really want to work together and figure out a good way. But I also agree that this is part of a broader policy issue that was noted by the superintendent. If we can't figure out how to provide the correct and appropriate mental health services and other type of supported services, then schools are going to be more and more strained with these kids. I think the overall goal here is to reduce the use of restraint and seclusion. Extending this procedure for another year is not getting us any closer to that overall goal. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stewart. Mr. Stewart and Mr. Larson, do you think in the next 2 weeks you'd be able to work out something with the department and with Representative Dabney? Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair, we can certainly put in an effort, and we've met with Representative Dabney and the department, and we'll continue to do that.
Thank you very much, because I'm going to lay this over so that you can continue your discussions, and we'll take the bill up later. But is there discussion for these two gentlemen? I know, Representative Greiling, you have a question. Representative Woodard, I believe you're first. Is it applicable to this?
It is.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your testimony, because some of the things that you brought up were some of the issues I noticed in the report. So I'm glad that you're here to kind of illuminate some of those. One of the things that kind of is a little disturbing in what we're doing here is that we've said that prone restraint is a face-down position. And at the same statute, we're talking about the fact that it's prohibited to impair breathing. What sort of position, and maybe you are the wrong people to ask the question of, but I'm curious as to what position you could put a child in a face-down position. I mean, how do you do that without impairing their breathing?
Mr. Stewart.
Madam Chair and members, I think that's a very important question, and as I'm an attorney, I can't really answer that question directly, but I do know that looking at the different training organizations that go out to different organizations, including schools, they do this training in states and in facilities that have a ban on prone restraint. So there are other options available. And certainly, you know, given the video that we saw, we need to figure out some good strategies to intervene that keeps everyone safe. But I think that looking at these training organizations and the experiences of other schools, other states, there are all those methods available. And I think that one thing that we need to do is to get some clinicians who have expertise in this area and a broad selection of them, so we can get to that consensus of how best to address that underlying difficult behavior without prone.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you. Representative Woodard, I'm one of what turns out to be several members on this committee who at one point made a living working in psychiatric settings and doing prone restraints. It's been a long time, and hopefully the techniques are better, and it was a psychiatric setting, not an educational setting. But I would direct you to the A2 amendment, specifically page 2, lines 22 through 25, that was adopted, where we put further restrictions on the use and implementation of prone restraint for student safety. Specifically so, in the process of the restraint, we do not impede the student's ability to set, to identify distress and things like that as a technique question. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Shaler, did you have a response to Representative Woodard's question? Please be seated. Say your name again and
My name is Melissa Shaler, and in response to the question about implementation of prone restraint, all of the three intermediate districts and several other districts throughout the state actually use professional crisis management. PCM is how it's referred to as our training for staff. It's a 22-hour training. A part of that, which is actually how to implement restraints, and one of those being the prone restraint. So when a prone restraint is done for us, we actually do prefer the prone versus a supine, which is a face-up, because many of our students have sexualized issues, and that's not a safe position for them. They don't feel safe in that position. It is done on a mat. It is a special mat that is obtained through that company and part of that training. The way that it is implemented does not restrict breathing for them. So it's a very systematic, thoughtful, well-developed process that we're using, and the staff that are implementing do have specific training.
Thank you, Ms. Shaler, for adding to that. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that's it's a great explanation. I appreciate that, which I think kind of leads to the fact that I'm glad this bill is being laid over and some more discussions are being had, because that sounds like in the intermediate districts there is good training, maybe even the right equipment to be able to handle these issues, and it's where a lot of the issues are occurring, as opposed to, I see Austin School District had quite a few incidents, and, interested in finding out what's happening in Austin that you would have that many incidents. But it sounds like if we can focus the training and focus what we're doing here on where the issues are really bubble up to the greatest extent, that's a great idea. So I appreciate you bringing it forward, Representative Dabney, and I think you're on the right track.
Ms. Shaler?
If I may just interject, I think that, as Barb talked about earlier this morning, the districts that are going to use prone do submit a list of their trained staff to the department so that the department knows that they have received that training. I happen to be the director of special ed in my previous position in Austin, Minnesota, and so I do have a close tie there. I know districts like Austin, I know districts like Moorhead, they are using that same PCM training. I do feel it's a widespread implementation. It's a conversation that we've had in our MACE meetings, both area meetings and our board meetings. It's a topic. We want our staff to be prepared. And we want to provide the safest intervention when we need to for our students.
Representative Griley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to say this hearing is a luxury because we're working on issues. It's not one of those armed partisan camp hearings, and so I thank you for having it, and two bills in a row where we're struggling for what's best for students in a very nonpartisan way. I noticed on the report that it just came out on February 1st, and so we haven't had a lot of time to figure out with that information what to do. So I'm very supportive of this bill for one more year. If something could be worked out in the next 2 weeks, of course that would be a miracle and very nice as well. I'm concerned though. And I do have a couple questions, but I just will say generally, I'm concerned that even after 1 year goes by, I'm worried that we might still not have a resolution of this. And if we're not looking at something like no prone restraints and is kind of like all kids will have 100% AYP by 2014. And Representative Benson, with his line of questioning, I think already pursued that. But my question, and maybe it's for whoever has read the report carefully, which I have not. I just read some summary things about it before this hearing. I'm wondering how many of the documented cases, if any, of the prone restraint are already illegal uses of the law where they weren't really emergencies. And then Mr. Stewart, I think, mentioned the same student was restrained more than once. And I'm wondering if the same students in the report that were restrained more than once, was it all in the same day which in which case I would consider it like one instead of however many it was, or was it spread out through the year? Those are my two questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greiling, and we may need Ms. Case down here again because, you know, this report is from MDE, but Mr. Stewart, go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, I have read the report quite thoroughly. My reaction is that there are certainly repeated use on the same student on the same day, but there are many other examples of how there are the prone restraint used on the same student over the course of the four and a half, 5 months that we've had. So certainly there is both, but the repeated use, especially over time, that's one of our main concerns. I think there was another part of the question that I don't quite
Representative Greiling,
right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It was right now with current law, where we say prone restraint is only for emergency situations or physical or seclusion, I guess that is. I'm wondering if there's any instances in this report that would be factored into the numbers where they already were not following the law and they were outside what even the current law is.
Members, on page 16, we do have the chart, but go ahead, Mr. Stewart, to answer Representative Greiling's question.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Greiling. The Department of Education also has some data on its website that doesn't appear on the report, and there's some narrative text on that precise question, and I think that the discussion of whether or not the districts are in violation has to be a little bit more broad than what's in that because there's all sorts of different factors. But it does appear that there are some non-emergency uses, some non-review of the contraindications, the medical contraindications, and as well as maybe the prone restraint not being the least intrusive intervention used at that time. However, again, it's isolated to the report that's just right there, and a full legal conclusion and all that needs to be more in-depth. So I can't really say that without looking at the entire documents, but it certainly seems that there are some concerns in those areas.
Ms. Case, any follow-up?
Barbara Case, Madam Chair, Representative Greiling. I have so much to say about, based on the question that you just asked. I think one of the most simple responses would be there were 286 reports at the time that we stopped counting the data in order to prepare the report, and there were 592 what we called incidents, and that's how the department tried to in some way address the question that you're raising of how many reports. Sometimes reports came in, and again, thank you for the amendment addressing that there will be probably a uniform form now. Sometimes reports came in from a district with multiple uses and even multiple days on the same student. Sometimes a report came in, it was one report with what we would call one incident of the student being held. Sometimes it was one student being held multiple times throughout the day, or sometimes over a short period of time, which is all to say it's complicated, and the department didn't report the data out in to that degree of detail, in part simply because we didn't have time and in part simply because we weren't asked. We tried to respond to what we thought our charge was.
Representative Greiling, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that answers my questions.
Mr. Larson, did you have something to add? Very good. Are there other questions or concerns? Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was looking at the graph on page 17, and I really thought in having this conversation, looking at the prone restraint, that the age of those who are being restrained would be a little bit older. And if anyone could speak to why at age 10 we see a need to use prone restraint at such a high number.
Mr. Stewart.
I'm sorry, I was just hearing something. I'm sorry, I didn't hear
so
the question.
So I was looking at the graph on page 17, and before looking at the graph, I just really thought that maybe the need to use prone restraint was used on older youth. But here we see a high number of 10-year-olds being restrained. Can anyone speak to why at 10 we're using prone restraint?
I think we have another expert here, so please say your name for the record and try to answer the question Representative Moran has asked.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Laura Keller-Gouch, and I'm the Executive Director of Special Education for Intermediate District 287. And in reviewing the data, you'll see that the majority of the prone restraints have been used on students that are between the ages of 9 and 11. We did report the use of prone restraint on a student that is 21. He is currently exiting from the educational system this year. He comes to us from a crisis group home and is severely mentally ill and frequently comes to school and is in need of support by up to 5 to 6 staff for throughout the day. And this is a student who the use of prone restraint is also done in the group home through the Rule 40, and we collaborate closely with the group home and use a similar procedure to support him when he is in a mental health crisis, which occurs frequently. I believe that we reported about 20 prone restraints with this particular student. This is an isolated situation. It's very uncommon to use prone restraint with any students that are over 14 in our district.
Madam Chair and Representative.
Mr. Stewart.
My overall impression is that looking at a lot of research on this question about the age, it is in line with that research that prone restraints and other forms of restraints and seclusion are used with younger children. And a number of the theories are, part of it is that kids are smaller and that it's harder to do these restraints and seclusion with the older, stronger, bigger kids. And there's less of a concern with that. There are also some, perhaps some psychological or developmental reasons there, but the one that I've seen in the research the most is a lot to do with the size of the child.
Representative Moran,
follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, to me, it seems like if a child is younger and smaller, I don't see why the need to grab a 10-year-old and have them face down on the floor as a way to restrain that child. For me, I just see it, the need maybe, and I understand you saying that an old child is really, older youth is really harder to restrain them in that fashion. But for a younger child, as young as 9 to 11, this is seen a little bit excessive to me.
Mr. Stewart.
Madam Chair and members, I think that's a very valid point, but I do know from the cases that we receive in our office is that sometimes these kids, even though that they're smaller and younger, they're very aggressive and violent, and things need to be done to protect that student and other students and staff from harm. But I think that the overall question is exactly right. Why is it that we need this particular restraint when, as I understand, there are others available that are not so intrusive? And perhaps other clinicians
yes.
that can answer better.
Well, the hour has come for us to adjourn, and so, members, I thank you very much for an excellent discussion. And with that said, I would like to place 2293 as amended, not on the table, but lay it over, members, so that Representative Dabney can continue discussions. And please, after you've read the report from MDE, I'll offer your suggestions as well. With that, members, the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.